Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. And just a quick heads up that this will probably be a fairly short podcast. I have to step on a plane to go to Scale 4, which is the Southern California Area Linux Expo, in just a couple of hours, and I still haven't even packed yet, so I'm going to try to keep this pretty short. First LQ story I have is that voting for the 2005 LinuxQuestions.org Members' Choice Awards is still underway. It does look like we're definitely going to set another voting record here, but if you haven't voted yet, you do now have less than a month to do so. The Members' Choice Awards allow you to pick the best in 20 categories, and this includes Browser of the Year, Distribution of the Year, Desktop Environment of the Year, and a variety of others that you would expect. This is your chance to be heard, so please do vote. The next LQ story I have is work is continuing on the social networking aspects of LQ, and I had mentioned this in last week's podcast. You can now easily find members using the same or even similar Linux distributions as you or as any other member. This is in addition to the ability to easily see your entire social network and your friend's entire network and to easily add and remove members from that view. Now, to utilize the distribution functionality, just go to any member's profile, and you'll see that the distribution list is now linked, so just click on any of those links to find a member using that distribution. I have a couple ideas on where I'd like to take the social networking aspect of the site next, but I still am interested in how LQ members would like to see this progress, so if you have any ideas, please do contact me. I finally did a little bit of digging into the stats here for the LQ Radio site, and I found a few things that were pretty interesting and I wanted to share them with you listeners. While each audio file typically gets somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,200 downloads, and that's an average, the low seemed to be about 3,100, and a couple of the episodes got linked from various places and got considerably more, but that's the average. Now, of those, only about 1,300 of the downloads seem to come via automated podcast via the RSS feed, and that was much, much lower than I had expected. I would have thought probably 80% of the downloads would have been podcasted. So if you are listening to this and are manually downloading each episode, I highly recommend that you look into automating it via Podcatcher. That way, whenever we do release any kind of audio content, it'll just be automatically downloaded and waiting for you to listen to, as opposed to you having to keep visiting the site. So this brings us to our next step. Of the people that are using a podcatcher, what are they using? A full 40% use iTunes, and considering that iTunes doesn't run on Linux unless you have Crossover Office, I was surprised to see it in first by such a huge margin. The next iPodder and Juice, the next two, are at about 10% each, and from there it drops off extremely fast. Of all the online services that are currently offered, Audio was number one, and they had about 3-4%. For what it's worth, I use Bashpodder, and I'm going to be covering that in an upcoming Linux Magazine article that I wrote. But since it uses wget, it's not going to show up in stats like these, because a lot of people manually downloading it are also going to use something like wget. For those of you not using a podcatcher, if there's a reason you're not, I'd like to hear that just to kind of see how the workflow is going. It might be something that a lot of us aren't anticipating on this side. So if you don't use it and there's a reason you don't use it, please drop me a line, either an audio comment, an email, or even a comment on the LQ Radio site. Thanks. Now on to the news. The first story I have is in regards to OpenOffice.org and an independent foundation. A recent VNUnet article insinuated that Sun is being asked to create an independent foundation with OpenOffice.org. That would be similar to what IBM did with Eclipse and what's been done with the Mozilla Foundation. One of the main reasons given behind this is that IBM is not currently willing to give code back to the OpenOffice.org project under the current situation, which requires you to sign over rights to Sun, so they can then include those improvements that were donated into StarOffice, which is a commercial application, as well as OpenOffice.org, which is obviously the open source application. Now, at this point, IBM has what basically amounts to a friendly fork in its workplace product. It's quite easy to see both sides of this one if you look at it. Sun purchased StarOffice for very real money, and turned around and LGPL'd it in less than a year. So they invested in it and then immediately turned around, I think as quickly as they possibly could have, and open sourced it. They currently employ about 80% of the contributors, and most of them remaining percent is actually employed by Novell. So the article pointed out that there's, you know, very few community contributions. And it's interesting that one of the highest profile open source projects doesn't have all that much community participation at a code level, although at a code level, either does Firefox, you know, to be fair. Now, I've heard multiple reasons for this, but I'm honestly and admittedly not close enough to the OpenOffice.org community to really definitively verify any of these. One recurring thing that I do read or see a lot is that the build system is extremely convoluted and that the code is extremely complex, and it's basically a bad enough situation there that you have to be paid to be interested to work on the projects. So whether that's true, I, like I said, I really don't know, but I do hear both of those quite a bit. The other reason I often see is the aforementioned requirement that contributions be licensed directly to Sun. So back to the issue, Sun has a vested interest in keeping control of the code, and that's so they can recoup their Star Office investment and really to justify the number of employees that they have working directly on the project. Now, IBM, on the flip side of the coin, understandably is not interested in paying their own developers to write code, only to have it show up in the commercial Star Office. I'm quite sure they don't have a problem with it showing up in the open source, OpenOffice.org, but writing code to have it directly be used by a competitor, you can see where they might have an issue with that. So Sun is in a bit of a jam, it would seem. Now, to be honest here, I don't think that Sun has really ever gotten enough credit in the open source community for what they did with OpenOffice.org. But this decision really comes down to what they want to do with the product long term. If they want to continue down the current path, slowly improving the product, but also bearing most of the associated cost with improving the project, and then selling Star Office in the current manner, we probably won't see an OpenOffice.org foundation anytime soon. Now, on the other hand, if they're willing to slightly change their paradigm, I think it could work for everyone involved. And the only loser I can see out of that would probably be Microsoft. And that's because some of the changes that IBM are doing really do look nice, and especially with regards to performance, which is one of the biggest OpenOffice.org complaints that I hear. Really, a unified and energized OOO foundation that was backed by both IBM and Sun really, I think, could put a hurting on Office sales. And if you remember, Office sales are a huge part of Microsoft's profit. The one thing I think we often forget in the open source community is that the code here is by all rights the property of Sun. Acting like they're the bad guy in cases like this only make us look fickle and hard to work with. I think all too often that scares a lot of companies away from open source. Now, extremely commendably in this case, the project leader, who is Luis Serres Potts, and I probably murdered that last name, I do apologize, he could not be handling this in a more professional and more poised way. He's not making a stink. He's not demanding anything. He's not making Sun look bad. He's not ridiculing Sun. He's simply pointing out what he thinks and why he thinks it would be advantageous. And I think there is a ton to be learned here, a big lesson. Regardless of how this plays out, I think he set a very good example of how the open source community can interact with the larger corporations that sometimes back it. So kudos to him. Now, about a day after the VNUnet article hit, Andy Updegrove pointed out that the title and some of the wording in the VNUnet article is greatly over-exaggerated. Indeed it is, and I couldn't agree more, and disappointingly, this is becoming the norm these days. Anything to grab headlines, anything to grab eyeballs and get readers, regardless of if you're stretching the truth so far that it's debatable whether it's the truth anymore. Unlike Andy, though, I wouldn't go as far to say that this is a complete non-story. In his article, I think he focuses a little bit too much on ODF, which is the open document format, which isn't the whole issue in this case. As he correctly states, IBM and Sun are indeed working on an ODF together, and that is absolutely fantastic. Great to see, and that's really the point of ODF, is to have multiple, reliable, trustable corporations that are working on competing projects that both back ODF. So if you can get an ODF office suite from Sun and one from IBM, that's ideal. But as it stands, IBM, to my knowledge, correctly stated in the VNUnet article, will not contribute code to OpenOffice.org itself. Now, this is one place that legitimately and realistically I think a foundation might be able to help. In addition to just IBM, I've also seen a fair number of people who contractually couldn't submit code to a project owned by a corporation such as Sun, but could donate it to an independent nonprofit. And I'll leave the legality and really stupidity of those kind of contracts for a separate conversation, but I have seen those, and whether they would hold up in court or not, it will still deter people. So in the end, and as I just mentioned, the code is Sun's, and they should be able to do what they think is best. It's going to be interesting to see what they do think is best and how they're going to position both OpenOffice.org and really StarOffice long term. I think it could have a huge impact on the office space. A quick follow-up to something that I mentioned at the end of last week's podcast regarding the Linux kernel and the GPL version 3. Linus has given some further explanation on why he doesn't like the current draft of the GPL version 3, but makes it very clear if the issues that he has with the draft are worked out in the final version, he does not have a problem using it. So a lot of this seems to stem from the fact that he doesn't like the anti-DRM clause, but there are also other reasons, and it appears that the issue that, quote, seems to disallow digitally signed binaries, or rather, you can sign the binary any way you want, but you have to make your private key available, end quote, and that was a quote from Linus, is really more of an issue for him. Now, I tend to agree that the layer of the license that the GPL falls into is probably not the place to fight the DRM battle. As insidious as DRM is, and as much as I hate it, I would agree, and he says the Creative Commons level, which is the license that you would use to actually license the artistic works, that's probably the battle for DRM, not a software license. One thing I think that is very clear out of all this is that there are a ton of confusion, both in the anti-DRM clause and in the aforementioned change to part 1 about the digital signing. So some people are taking that to mean, and obviously Linus is in this camp, that distributions would have to release their private keys, which obviously can't happen, while others are stating, and many others, that this is unequivocally not the case and it's a misinterpretation. So hopefully the next draft, and I'm assuming there's going to be more drafts that aren't the final version yet, will clear these things up. Should be noted here that Alan Cox recently commented that he didn't think the cross-pollination value between the Linux kernel and, say, the Open Solaris kernel would be as high as some had thought. And that's because even if you can see the code and use the code, because at the kernel level, things are very specific to that kernel, that you're not just going to be able to copy and paste a big chunk of code from one to the other. You might get ideas, but the code's going to basically have to be rewritten from scratch, and you can get ideas without seeing the code. So he doesn't seem to be of the mindset that even if you could share code, that it would be a huge win. In the end, though, it's still clear that there's still a ton going on with this story that's going to change, and it seems for some reason, and this comes back to the press issue that I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, they're trying to create some huge Linus versus the GPL3 or Linus versus Stallman controversy where it really just doesn't exist. So no big surprise. This is obviously an important story to Linux, the kernel, and open source in general. But as more drafts come out, I think we'll get more information, and then we can make some educated decisions. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us.